You know what time it is? That's right, it's a new ad. And this time I have two amazing stories for you to check out. First one is about a friend Saving Throw, who writes a story called So When Am I a Hero? It's a system apocalypse that is quite frankly amazing. I don't like system apocalypses usually, and I devoured that one. So go and check it out. There's a link below the podcast. The second one is from another friend of mine, because I have two friends, called The Infinity Dungeon by Reject Humanity. Premise is actually pretty cool. A guy goes hiking on the Appalachian Trails and stumbles into the only and first dungeon in the world, and he's the only person on Earth with a system, at least for a while. All right, go check him out. I appreciate it a lot, and I'll see you next time.
I'm the kind of guy where you give me a new video game, and I'll play it for an hour. I'll realize where I screwed up, I'll stop. I'll play it for another hour, realize where I screwed up, stop. And then my third playthrough is when I'm serious on it. And that's kind of how I wrote. I wrote two books that were god awful. And then I wrote a book that was all right. And then I started writing seriously after that. So like by the time you actually started seeing anything that was getting anywhere near Amazon or Royal Road, you were looking at my third book.
This is the Crit RPG Podcast, your one-stop shop for everything Lit RPG, Progression Fantasy, and Royal Road. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Crit RPG Podcast. And if you see me being green today, it's not because I'm envious. No, it's because I'm here with Cale Plamen, author of Tower of Somnus, and as we've discussed before the podcast in the bonus material, lots of other books too. Really nice. How are you doing, Cale?
Pretty good. Good to be here.
Yeah. We've been having, I think, like 45 minutes of fun before the podcast. This is great. Before like the YouTube show. And this is like the obvious plug. Go to my Patreon. Go check it out if you want to. I won't bother you with more of those. Maybe at the end. Can't promise. But yeah.
Subscribe to his Patreon.
Yes. I need to like add like a hypnosis loop in this, like subscribe to my Patreon.
Like a third panel with like Hypnotoad from Futurama.
Yeah. Or like the thing from like Family Guy. It's like this is the greatest TV show you have ever seen, except for maybe The Wire, right? Breaking Bad, and it's fun. So I think without further ado, we should like completely let's like jump into it. Tell us about your books. Pitch them to us and tell us why you wrote them.
The sort of pithy response as to why I wrote them is the one that I have in my author bio, which is that I am a longtime dungeon master, but as everyone's getting older and having kids and going on vacations, it's hard to wrangle everyone together. And so you, my dear readers, are a captive audience that when I tell a story, you're there and you listen to all of it and you don't complain about critical hits. So thank you for that.
Well, no one complains about critical hits in Lit RPG. Yeah. Because it's, Okay. You're in the right place if you like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But book-wise, I really took a weird and meandering route to Lit RPG. I think earlier we were talking about like genre fiction and how, norms in romance and norms in Lit RPG. I actually sort of came here via paranormal romance, which is kind of weird. It is a very different world. I've read a lot of romance just because like I read a whole bunch of fiction, which is, I'm sure, not abnormal for anyone, you know, listening to this. So I read a whole lot of romance, whole lot of like traditional Golden and Silver Age, sci-fi and fantasy. And then I kind of moved on from the paranormal romance to Wuxia, Zhangjia. I am sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, but the sort of, you know, like the stuff that was on like Wuxia World for a while. And then I started getting into the like real dark place where I was listening to like reading the like machine translated stuff that like would have like 500 readers total. And like, you know, you get to like, it was just like borderline incomprehensible because it was like the old really bad machine translators. And then while I was doing all that, I found Royal Road. And then I found Amazon and I found Lit RPG on Amazon. And I'm like, wow, this is, you know, like the machine translated stuff I'm reading, but it's a lot better. And so then I started reading Lit RPG and I'm like, no, this is just kind of the better version of what I was reading. And then I got really into it. And then I also, what was the other one I always credit as my inspiration is, you know, I kind of had the imposter syndrome thing going where like, I think I have a book in me, but I don't know. It's really hard to write a book. I've been doing NaNoWriMo. I have a couple really bad books none of you will ever see because trust me, they're really bad. That isn't imposter syndrome. I've reread them. They're really freaking bad, man. But so like, I'm like, you know, can I write a book? Can't I? And then I got drunk and I watched The Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, okay.
And I just had this thing where I'm watching this movie where the plot is borderline incoherent. It's just special effects, plot holes, non sequiturs, just coming at you a mile a minute. And I you know, this is well after it had come on the movie theater, and I pull out my phone and I look it up, and this movie made $1 billion.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, if Rise of Skywalker can make $1 billion, I can write a book, and I could write something better than Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah,
like I you know, I might not be at the biggest audience, but I can find an audience. Like I can clear that threshold, and so that was my inspiration.
I have so many friends who need to hear this because they are like, well, I don't know if I can read this book. Maybe isn't all that good. I'm looking at you, Sam. I'm looking at you. Like, just read the fucking book, man. Like, yeah. The worst that's going to happen is like, you get a mean comment. Oh, no.
Well, you could write War and Peace and get a mean comment. You're always going to get mean comments. But
no, you don't understand, Kale. If my book is perfect, no one's going to be mean to me. I'm going to be universally accepted and loved.
Yeah, yes. Sure. I have books that don't get mean comments because I shut comments down. Yes.
Perfect.
That's
book.
The only way easy to do it.
Like yeah. the one trick all authors hate. Like just disable comments.
Problem solved. No. The other one is like, this is a joke that my dad used to tell me when we would go like canoeing and hiking. Mm-hmm. Which is, if you see a bear, you don't have to outrun the bear. You have to outrun the guy standing next to you.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my thing on writing. Is like, to this day, I'll reread my books and I'll be like, oh, wow, there's a whole bunch of stuff that didn't hit exactly how I wanted it to. Mm-hmm. The scene didn't gel the way I wanted it to. But at the end of the day, if you, as an author, ever apply the same sort of lens that you apply to your work to a major published work, mm-hmm. like if you just go back and reread, you know, someone really good, like Brandon Sanderson, you'll mm-hmm. find, you know, things like the same word starting two sentences in a row, the sorts of things that like cause me to have conniptions when I'm writing. And at the end of the day, if you draw someone in, they're not going to notice it. They're having a good time. They're liking the book. And what you need to do is you need to learn that, you know, there are things you should be doing to try and improve your craft. But at the end of the day, you know, just write it. And if people don't like it, they don't like it, but they'll probably, you know, you'll probably at least have some people like it.
And like, If you're looking at like some very, very, very successful novels on Railroad, they're not mastercraft novels. Like I'm not putting anyone last here. Like Rhaegar, for example, like he redid his entire first book and it's like tremendously better, right? He wrote pretty much all of Azarenth Healer, and I think it's like it's a really good book now, right? But it's writing for like making the perfect piece of art that you love is great, but you either do that and then you never publish it and you shut up about it because it's for you and you only, or you accept that there is always going to be people who don't like what you're writing and you put it out there and you appreciate the people who do like it, right? It's either or. Everything in between is just a recipe for misery.
Yeah, no, and like one of the other things, part of the reason why my advice to baby writers is always, you know, it's overset, but just write, is Azarenth Healer is a great example of this. It's what I sometimes call juice, where you have this sort of like X factor that's like, how the characters gel together, how the plot hits its beats, how the tempo of the plot works. If you read Azerinth Healer, the way that the power levels move on, there's always this sense of exploration and wonder. And he even has a tagline for it. You know, there's always another Drake. Like that is such a great motif, because at the end of the day, I don't know if you thought this out, but at the end of the day, it is a story about exploration and discovery. That is the core of Azerinth Healer. And he found a great motif for it that he could have as sort of a coda that he would come back to. And it is a book where, even though before the rewrite, some of the prose was rough, it had impeccable juice. It just had it, the tempo, the gel, everything was so amazing that it was real easy to skip past the prose. And then he fixed the prose. So go read it. It's really good.
And I think, like what you were just saying, like the motif, the core concept of the story is something I've learned to appreciate more and more and more as I write, because it helps you so much in every single aspect. If you know what your story is really about, then you know what not to write. You know why the thing that you're writing is boring. You know why your readers are dropping off, is because they might not even know what the fridge your motif is, but everyone can feel it. It's like it's like a smell, like a sense, right? So I got this whole idea about the concept from a book that Phil Tucker recommended. It's called Take Off Your Pants, and it's by Libby. You will find it if you Google it. It's a really, really good book. It's about plotting in a way that doesn't scare us poor pantsers. It's really good. And she has like this idea of like the core motif. And her example is Charlotte's Web, where Wilbur the pig, has to learn about like life and death, and that death is unavoidable and that life is still good, even though there's death in it, right? Because at the end, he always tries to like escape death. He always tries to like be immortal. And then at the end, like Charlotte, his spider friend, dies, and he's like super heartbroken about it, because like that's the lesson he needs to learn. And if you're looking at any lit RPG that's like doing really, really super well, there's always a core motif. Primal Hunter is like a super easy motif, right? Because it's like, I want to go stronger because I want to defend my friends, right? There's not much to learn there, right? But it's just like, oh, God damn it, I'm going on a tirade. The idea is with flat characters is not they discover some sort of truth, but they have a truth and they teach it to the world. And the way Primal Hunter teaches it to the world is with violence, which is good, right? Like
good for the genre,
One Piece too, right? One Piece, the motif is like, I want to have a really cool band of friends like my hero Shanks, and I want to go around the world and explore the world and liberate people to have their own freedom. That's the thing, right? And that's like the whole like freedom versus like government thing. And you can find that motif, to end the sentence, you can find that motif in everything, right? Every single island is about basically freedom to do what you want and being nice versus rules and oppression and oppression in either the criminal or governmental way. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
No, and I mean, like, that's the thing. It's like, sometimes we call them elevator summaries or executive summaries. Every series, if you're writing it, needs to have an executive summary. So, for example, Dream of Wings and Flame, one of my series, is a monster evolution series about a kobold that is absolutely convinced that he's a dragon, and it's just a matter of time before he finishes evolving into one. And so the theme thematically, what it is it's blind optimism can change the world. That's your like.
Aww,
like
your, that's cool. Your
well, that's the thing. It's like, so he's his entire thing is that he is so convinced that this is going to work that he just sort of makes things happen. He takes risks that are absolutely idiotic, but he's convinced that things are going to work out because it's his destiny.
That's compelling.
And things happen that way. And you know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on, but like, that's the thing, is like, you need to be able to describe your entire series in one to two sentences, because like, I think it was a, I think it's a Ronald Reagan quote, but it works for everything, which is, if you're explaining, you're losing.
Mm-hmm.
Where if your reader can't sort of glean the feel for what you're doing through your work, and it isn't something simple that they can easily pick up on, you're making a mistake. So like, you know, Tower of Somnus is corporate dystopia mixed with an alien invasion and try in survival, you know, when you're sort of like being like ripped apart between these two forces. So that's your like sort of like core, everything comes back to those thematic elements. So like every book is going to have some element of that. And, you know, I was talking about how one of my earlier books, Blessed Time, is a time loop. And the reason why I got some pushback on that is because I broke my core motif. My original core motif was there's time loops, and no matter what you're doing, you're making things worse through the time loops. And it's him suffering through the results of his actions as the time loops keep getting worse and worse.
Which is another problem.
And then the second half in the final two books is more of a standard fantasy situation where there's, you know, a big evil guy and you need to, you know, collect the artifacts you need and prepare to defeat the big evil guy, but it doesn't use the time loops anymore. And those are both, like, both of those are just fine. They're just fine motifs. They're just fine, you know, ideas for how to write and how to structure things. But by sort of like breaking it like that, there were a significant number of people who were just like, hey, what's going on? This book doesn't feel the same. And it's because I changed it. It's because thematically, motif-wise, it functionally is a different series, even if it has the same characters in the same, you know, world and the same, you know, magic system.
Like, I think Brandon Sanderson, one of his lecturers, I remember that vividly, one said, like, don't pull a complete 180 on your readers. Right? Like, don't make it a romance story that's actually about a serial killer and you only notice this in the middle of the book. Because people who want to read serial killer stories won't get hooked by it. And people who do get hooked because they like romance get disappointed. And it's kind of like the same. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I mean, while we're at hooks or motifs, what's some other motifs you want to... You have like two more, right?
Yes and no. So one of them is more what I would call me executive producing a book. I did developmental editing on it. I'm not a ghostwriter guy, so I'm not taking any money from it. It's the other guy's book, but my name is on it because in part for marketing purposes, in part because I worked pretty closely with him during the writing, but I don't want to take any credit from Alex. That's his baby. That's his book. He wrote it. And then the other series is Viceroy's Pride. And the motif from that one's actually pretty meta. It's just kind of like it's a love letter to the genre. Like, it's just, I smashed a lot of things together that I thought were cool and tried to do it in a fun way. Okay. So it's the main character. Basically, there's a botched alien invasion and we get magic from the botched alien invasion, but the aliens are coming back. And so we're trying to figure out how to fight back against the aliens. And so it's the main character is sent to another world to try and get the magical stuff they need to start awakening, you know, wizards on Earth so we can fight back. And then there's a war with the aliens. And then there's, you know, another alien race. There's a lot of, like, you know, space elves, space orcs, people in, like, magically powered power armor and magic mechs blowing up space orcs in like New York City and stuff like that. Cool. But there's like a whole bunch of callbacks where one of the running jokes is that it's a lit RPG, but it kind of is tongue in cheek about how lit RPG is illogical sometimes. And so one of the main characters, like the system in it, is based off of, it's basically aimbots. There's like nanobots that are in people, and the idea is that magic is incredibly complex and hard to cast. And the nanobots just sort of remember all of these, like, you know, mini muscular movements or whatever that you're doing in order to cast it, and they do it for you. And so skill levels are like the nanobots in your arms helping guide your sword, for example.
That's nice.
But so the main character is like, why are we dividing this into levels? Like, why are you making this seem like a role-playing game? And it turns out that the person who is funding this entire thing is an eccentric billionaire that had, like, you know, ran a whole bunch of MMORPGs. He's like, well, it looks like an RPG because I think RPGs are cool, and I'm the guy with $10 billion. And that's their answer.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
And then like that guy shows up and he's like, well, I'm sending you to another planet, so you have to start a harem. And that's another one where, you know, don't confuse your readers. I confuse my readers because I was never going to write a harem, but I just the dodgy old billionaire, like taking the like 28-year-old guy aside, putting an arm over his shoulder and be like, need to bang all the elf girls, is like exactly what it would like be like the sort of like, this is kind of what, you know, what happens in the genre, even if I'm not going to do it. And so then I got like a whole bunch of people who are like, I dropped the book because it's a harem. And then the other half of the people are like, I was promised banging elf girls. Like,
shout outs to Brian Norton. Yeah, like people always go like, it's a bit of an in joke if you haven't been on the podcast before. Brian Norton did an amazing podcast. You can go listen to it. And he has his main character, Sal, has carnal intercourse with a female in the first, I think, 15 chapters of book one. And people are like, is this harem? And he's like, he's Irish. We're both European. And for us, like, no, this is a regular standard college experience. What are you talking about? Right?
Yeah.
And like, I guess American sensibilities are a bit different. And Brian said in this wonderful, I think it's like a bass, I don't know what he was. He says like, I really pity you if you never had something like this happen to you in college.
Brian's great.
he's amazing. In the immortal worlds of Seth McDuffie, who was chatting with him and I was there. He said, I looked at this guy for 2 seconds and I was like, this guy fucks. So, yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, so my thing is, I always do fade to blacks, but like, I don't know. Like, one thing I like to do is like, I don't like to be too sort of quippy, but there need to be certain, like, you know, callbacks. Like, so the one that I really liked actually in Blessed Time, the time regression that I threw in there, is the main character regresses to being like 12 or whatever. And when he's about 14, he meets his love interest from the previous loop. Ooh. And and like at some point he reveals that he, you know, he's looped like 2 or 3 times and he's interested in her. And I just have one of these moments where it's like, I don't care that you're, you know, 1,000-year-old vampire. I'm not going to prison for this. I'm not sleeping with you, sort of like, like nod to anime moment.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
Like, but it was like the main character was a 1,000-year-old vampire rather than the like sort of like creepy love interest.
Oh God, yeah. Like this is actually a very, very good reversal. I like it a lot. It was fun. Okay. Tell me a little bit more about like how you wrote Tower of Somnus, or I'm also interested in Dreams of Wings and Fire. Dreams of Fire Wings?
Sure. So Tower of Somnus was, I was just kind of, I joke that I write a lot of series about things that I don't like. Mm-hmm. And Tower of Somnus was, I don't even know what VR MMORPG, like full dive, whatever I had read. I'm like, man, this fucking sucks. I don't know if you have to bleep me out or not, but like this sucks, right?
European podcast.
Yeah, no. So I'm like, this sucks. I think we deserve better than this. So I'm just sitting there and I'm like, I really, really don't like a lot of the VR MMORPGs out there. There are plenty that I like, but there's a lot of ones that were just rubbing me the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I want to write a VR MMORPG that works. And the primary problem I had is there was a lack of stakes.
Yeah.
That,
you can solve that by sort of setting it on a farm.
Yeah, and I mean, like, some people tried to achieve stakes by, like...
stupid pun.
Yeah, by, like, you know, oh, I'm raising money by selling in-game items to buy my sister medicine. Like the, you know, Moonlight Sculptor, literally the origins of Royal Road. But like,
Yeah.
But, like, that just didn't do it for me. And so that's how I kind of came to Tower of Somnus. And part of... part of what it is Tower of Somnus is a little tongue-in-cheek with some of the more esoteric political theories out there, where obviously it's cyberpunk, so it's like a hyper-capitalist dystopia. A lot of it is me just sort of like cranking corporate culture up to 12 because I think it's like really funny, or like, you know, having like euphemisms where like being fired means that you're mandatory donating organs and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
But the other one is there's this really, really, really funny meme sect of communism that existed for like 5 years in like, I think the 60s, called Posadism. And it was a whole bunch of people who just kind of looked around and they're like, look, we're never going to get to communism on our own. It just isn't happening, man. But communism has to happen, because at that point for some of these people, like, you know, it's borderline a religion.
Yeah.
And so their theory was that there were aliens, and because communism is so much better than everything else, the aliens had to be communist. And so what was going to happen is we were about to get into a nuclear war, and the aliens would have been here the entire time, and they're just going to jump out from Bush and they'd be like, holy crap, we need to stop World War III. And that's how we were going to get global communism, because it was never going to happen with humans. Humans were never going to manage it because we sucked too much.
Yeah.
And so like that was sort of like the element that I was bringing in, is the aliens show up. And I was also remembering there was a Star Trek Next Generation episode where they're trying to like check to see if a world can join the Federation. And at the end of it, Picard's like, these guys blow. No, this is a bad idea. And so so that's kind of what I was going with, is that the aliens show up, just kind of look around, and they're like, oh God, no. And like that sort of moment, because it, you know, it's kind of like the opposite of an alien invasion. The aliens are like, you guys are too broken to invade. Oh my God.
It's like that's you. I don't know, touching that, no.
Yeah, yeah. And like so that's kind of what I was going for. And then another thing that I had been thinking about writing forever is I read a lot of like sort of literature from like, you know, your Kiplings and your like, you know, your colonial authors and all of that sort of stuff. Like, you know, when I was in college, and there are a lot of these sort of like, you know, tropes about the savageness and everything. And I had always had this idea in the back of my head to write a novel where Earth was colonized and we're just kind of normal people, but all of these tropes about these like bestial savages that like can't be reasoned with or whatever are being used to like dehumanize us. And so that was kind of worked in there too. So it's just kind of like the aliens show up. They were just written off as unsalvageable. Other than that, they're like, look, we'll let you play a video game with our people. And if you can learn to play nice with your neighbors over the course of the next like 100 years of interacting with normal people, great, we'll let you into our big boy club. But until then, no one's allowed to go to your planet because you're all psychopaths.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I feel that. Yeah. I read the books. I love them. I especially love this like whole like duality, and you're playing with that a lot, right? Like one world, two worlds. Like this happens to Kat because of like her social status, and then not only social status, like upper and higher, but it also like is the whole like samurai, not samurai, and then you have like in-game world, the other world, and that shit gets never really gets complicated. Like the only thing I wish was we would see more of the tower, but I think that happens like more in like 4 and 5, right?
Yeah. No, I mean one thing is that 5, there's still plenty of stuff happening in the real world, but 5 is when the importance of tower climbing is starting to get more into the forefront in 4.
Yeah.
But like sort of the back half of the 6 book series is that there are reasons why Kat needs to hit a certain level by a certain time, or bad things happen, sort of stuff.
I like I said, I really, really enjoyed it. Like, I also really enjoyed the end of book 3. At first, I thought that was, this is like sudden. And I was like, oh no, actually, this makes a lot of sense. This is nice. Because, like, if you're saying it's a six book series, that makes a lot of sense. Like, yeah, I really like it. It was really good. Thank you. Yeah, and like you've piqued my interest with like Dream of Wings and Flame. So how do you go about that?
It's one of those things where like I think I misjudged the market. I think I loved Remonster, for example, which is now getting an anime and it's pretty good. But like I love that one. I loved Chrysalis, which is, you know, something people in our genre are more likely to read. I loved Chrysalis. I loved what was Veil the Howl's book. I didn't want to be a Hive Queen or something like that. But there were a couple of these Monster Evolution books that I really, really, really liked. And I saw a bunch of people like on Reddit, for example, asking for more of them. And the one problem I ran into when I wrote the book is that I think the people on Reddit who wanted more of them were all of the people that wanted more of them.
Yes.
so like there really isn't a huge market for it. I think it's one of my best written series. I really love the series. I really love the characters. I really love the sort of like world building that I'm weaving into it. I really love how I'm doing all of that. But there are a lot of people who just kind of look at a main character that's a kobold and say, I'm not reading about a kobold. And like, I don't know how to say, well, don't worry, he's not a kobold for long. But I don't know.
I think I talked with Actus about this, and he says like Monster MC is like super dead. I think like sometimes you can kind of like mix that into your smoothie a little bit, right? I have one project going on where I don't even mention it's Monster MCs. But like it's just like regular normal people, but like it's I would even hesitate to call it like furry-ish. It's not. It really isn't. Like, it's just look at normal people, and they have like powers.
Yeah, no, and I mean, so what's going to happen in that is the next three books in Dream Wings and Flame are dual MC, and one of the MCs is human. And the idea was that like we're sort of establishing the monster half of things before we start weaving everything together. So what I'm probably going to do is sort of like soft boot it as a new series that's related to the other series, because I think that readers are more likely to, you know, vibe with it if there are humans in it as well. But what I would say is that if it isn't a complete turnoff to you as a reader and you're vaguely interested in, you know, because I don't know, I think the magic system's real cool in that one too. I'd say give it a shot. I really think it's probably my best series. As much as I love Tower of Somnus, I think it's a little better than Tower of Somnus. But I picked a weird marketing niche for it, and that's on me. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, how else would you tell a story about a kobold who wants to become a dragon if it's not a kobold?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, makes complete sense. So what's the best advice you've ever gotten as a writer?
We talked about this a little bit earlier, but like some people learn better from reading about writing. For me, I'm the kind of guy where you give me a new video game and I'll play it for an hour. I'll realize where I screwed up. I'll stop. I'll play it for another hour. Realize where I screwed up. Stop. And then my third playthrough is when I'm serious on it. And that's kind of how I wrote. I wrote two books that were god awful. And then I wrote a book that was all right. And then I started writing seriously after that. So like by the time you actually started seeing anything that was getting anywhere near Amazon or Royal Road, you were looking at my third book. Because the ones before that were bad. What I did, which wasn't really advice, but what I would give as advice to other people is my first 3, 4, 5 books, I thematically would sort of emphasize some aspect of writing. So I have a book that I doubt many lit RPG readers would like. I think it's a great book. It's about 55,000-60,000 words. It's called As the God King Wills. I wanted to be able to write characters and interweaving plots without using fighting as a crutch. Cool. So it is literally a black comedy about a bunch of old priests serving a mad god. There is no combat. There's nothing else. And it's entirely about their political machinations, their friendships, their relationships, everything they're doing. And so, but that was like, I was like, I need to work on this. And then I had, you know, some books where I'm like, I need to work on my dialogue because my dialogue is stilted. I need to work on flow of time because flow of time is stilted. I need to work on tempo because, and so that's what it is. Like, I have a bunch of books that I consider functionally to be project books where the entire time I was writing them, I was trying to improve one aspect of my writing. And like one of my series that actually did pretty well is literally my action project book. Like I didn't even consider myself finished learning the introduction to writing yet when I published it. But like that's what it is keep writing and always be purposeful about writing. You know, anytime you're writing something, you need to be doing more than putting words on the page. All you need to know is why you're putting words on the page. There's no wrong answer. You just need to be thinking about what you're doing while you're doing it. And, you know, sometimes, like, you know, we'll have jokes where, like, you know, in Discords where it's like, you know, this person is going to be a good author someday. They just need to write another 200,000 words. And it's just true.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, like, this is like also the advice like most people like get, right? Just write. But I think Raven's Dagger said it, like, it's like write with purpose is what you're saying too, right? And this why can be anything. It can be, and here's my advice that I always used to give, and I have kind of fallen off of for a while. Set realistic goals, right? So don't go like, I want to be like the next Prime Hunter, or I want to be like, you've never written a word and you're like, I want to be the next Prime Hunter. Like, it's not going to happen. Like 99 out of 10, it's not going to happen unless you're like Lars Machmuller and like just have like a natural gift for words, I guess. But like,
I mean, you know what the goal was for my first book?
Yeah,
oh, I wanted to make enough. I wanted to make enough money off Patreon, pay for a professional looking cover for my next book.
That's a very cool idea. My first goal for releasing Torchbearer like 0.1, it was I want to get 5 followers. And I get that. And then I was like, cool, let's see if I can get 10, right? Yep. Because like human psychology is like really, really interesting. And basically you want to like manage dopamine a little bit, right? So stay away from lots of like dopamine reducing stuff like video games, for example. And instead use the dopamine that you have. Don't dump it into video game, like go and write. And then build your reward system, right?
Yep.
You don't get better at something by constantly feeling like a failure. So feel like a winner by setting goals that you could actually achieve.
The other piece of advice I'll give anyone is don't get overly emotionally invested in Royal Road.
That's really.
I love Royal Road. Royal Road's great. Royal Road also broke my brain for about a year just because like I was trying to write enough to produce for it while working a day job. Mm-hmm. I was trying to follow up with all of the comments and... Mm-hmm. You know, make changes based off of them. And then like once I started having books that were doing fairly well, I started obsessing over, you know, oh my God, I got a 2-star. Where did that come from? Like at one point, like I always joke that I was on the best rated jockeying with Dungeon Crawler Carl for the 4th through 6th spot for about 5 months. And I would say, well, you know, obviously we've sold about as well since then, right?
But obviously, yes.
Oh yeah. But like that was the thing is like, you know, I've got that like all that I really have from it is like this little fancy platinum number 4 tag on my Royal Road profile, which is cool. Don't get me wrong, but it's like I have folders on my old computer where I was like taking screenshots of like. When the numbers would go down for someone like 0.5 bombing me, comparing it to like, you know, when I was getting bad comments from people on like, you know, the comments, it just drove me crazy. Like, so what I'm currently not as involved as I should be, but what you should be doing is posting a chapter, maybe reading 4 or 5 comments from it, responding to them, respond to your comments on Patreon and interact with those people because they care enough about your writing to like actually pay you, which isn't so much because they're paying me, but I want to be interacting with the people that genuinely care about my writing rather than the person who's just showing up for like 5 minutes to be like, you suck, dude, and then move on to the next, you know, story or whatever. Yeah.
vent their like frustration about like getting out, getting dumped or whatever. like, yeah, like the most important part about that entire thing is like, it's usually not about you or not about me. Right. It's people have some sort of like, I don't know, experience, and then they have another experience. And I think the adage of people are always wrong, groups of people can be tendentially right, is like a very good adage. So I will go on record here. My current version of Torchbearer has a rating of 3.86. It's not a good rating. And for a while, like, if you had told me this like a year ago, like, or like half a year ago when I released it, I would be like, oh my God, it's terrible. But I'm like, yeah, it's really not that good. Because I did some mistakes. This is my first book, right? So I actually went back and rewrote it, and I'm going to see if the next relaunch does better. And if not, I'm just going to be like, you know what? This goes on Amazon, whatever. Like, I'm going to do 3 books and then whatever. But yeah, the point about trying to get people to your Patreon, if you have a Patreon, that's a good idea. But yeah, otherwise, if you're really on Royal Road, I recommend cultivating your comments. So if you have like, if you're not huge, if you don't have a Patreon yet, you can always go to Royal Road and like literally just block everyone who like gives you like a mean comment that you don't want to read. Always look at the feedback objectively if you can, and then if you don't want to read from them ever again, just block them. That's fine.
Well, I do something like that when someone gives me like a 2-star review. I'm not gonna complain to Kata and Wing and say take the review down. That's your honest opinion. Yeah. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, you clearly don't like my book, so I'm going to save you the temptation and the trouble of that, and I'm going to block you. So don't read my book. Yeah. You clearly don't want to read my book. That's fine. You know, it's a free country. That's, you know, you have your taste, I have mine. But if you don't want to read my book, don't read it. Like, just go away. Leave me alone.
It's like, they can still read it, but they can't comment anymore or rate.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean, they're entitled to their opinion. I've heard it and I disregarded it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, it's like, there's some reviews where I'm like, oh wow, ouch, ouch, ouch. But some of them are like really true. So again, like take everything with a grain of salt. Also, disable your ratings. Like, the ratings aren't there for anything but to make you feel bad. They're not for you, they're for the readers. They might explain why your book isn't gaining any traction if you're sitting like 1 star or whatever. Just try and give it some time. And as always, remember, you were saying don't get too emotionally attached. If you're emotionally attached to your book and you want your baby to do well, understand that not everyone's going to like your baby. It's fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I'm saying do as I say, not as I do. It's very easy to say that, but like the other thing is like when you hit an Amazon launch, oh my God, you know, first book in a series, I can barely sleep. I'm, you know, checking for Amazon refreshes, cool. You know, every hour. It just drives you crazy.
And I mean,
I'm just saying this isn't healthy. Also, I do it every time.
Yeah. When I relaunched Torchbearer, I made a challenge for myself. I want to try and not look at the ratings or anything for as long as I can. And that was fun as fuck.
Good idea.
Yeah. I did an entire month, and after that I needed to look at it again because I needed to like do some adjustments. But I was like, damn, I really want to break the streak. I would have happily never looked at the story ever if I could have. But it's same thing I'm gonna do for Amazon launch. It's out there, nothing I can change, nothing I could do about it, so good luck. Another point about cultivating comments, right? Talk to the people who like your story.
Yeah.
Tell them that you appreciate the comment and don't be like, thanks, but like really start a conversation. And even if they're just doing like, thank you for the chapter, I always go through all the thank you for the chapters and I respond in kind. So if someone writes like TYFTC, I write like TY.
The same thing. Thank you for the comment, right?
Thank you for the comment, like really short, or thank you very much for commenting. Or if I'm really funny, like thank you very much for commenting and or reading, but all in short, like this is like letter thing. And it had like real battles with like one dude who would always go like, thanks for writing. I'm like, thanks for reading. It's like, thanks for being entertaining. I'm like, no, thank you for being nice. And then, like, it was like, yeah, every chapter was fun.
Yep.
Yeah, and like, this is what you're doing this for. Like,
yeah.
If you're not earning money off of it, then it's literally about like finding people who like your stuff and learning how to disregard people who don't like it. Yeah, cool. All right. We've talked about best advice you've ever gotten as a writer. What's one thing that you've learned while writing that you no longer do or would love to go back and change?
Mostly, I sort of learned a lot of the genre rules for things that I should never have done, but kind of did. One of them is like giving my main character a boss that is like sort of mean to them. The translating, like I have a sort of like friendly mean relationship with my friends where we're kind of like jerks to each other, but that's sort of our friendship. And that does not translate to the page, especially in our genre, well, because if you have a main character and everything is through the eyes of your main character, and your the core conceit of our genre is that your main character may be weak now, but they're going to be powerful someday, you know, or they're not weak now, and they, you know, they start out strong, you know, something like that. It's all about like this becoming powerful, becoming somewhat important factor. Having someone be mean to them from a position of authority triggers that sort of like arrogant young master reflex in your readers. And when I meant this person to be a supporting character, everyone was like, no, they're the arrogant young master. You need to slap their face until, you know, they become like a pig or whatever. And when I didn't do that, I annoyed people to no end. And then the other thing I learned from that series as well is, oh my God, do not write about the real world. Unless you want to spend forever doing research.
Yeah.
I was writing, again, a very fast, loose, sort of like fun series where wacky things are happening in the real world. And I needed a ship full of soldiers to be in Florida. So I think I said, yeah, you know, military ship landed in Tampa. And I don't know what percentage of Lit RPG readers and authors are ex-military, but it's high. It's like 20% or something like that. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, Tampa sounds good. Like I'm going to be honest. If you give me a map of Florida, I couldn't even put Tampa on that map.
Tampa has a bay.
Yeah. Like that's where I'm at. Like I'm from the Midwest, man. I don't know. So I just was like, yeah, Tampa, there we go. And I had a lot of people who were very, very upset about how there wasn't actually like a military base there where the ships could land. And there wasn't like, it might've been like, you know, the bay wasn't deep enough. You know, they were completely right. Don't get me wrong. They were right. I was wrong. But also it's one of those things where like, if I'm writing about the real world, I have to do a whole lot of research into it. And like Tower of Somnus is as close as I'm going to ever get again.
Yeah.
In that it's like a cyberpunk magic fantasy. But even there, I'm sure that the FBI has me in some sort of watch list because like learning how to dispose of bodies in oil drums filled with lye, for example. I from that, I actually learned that quicklime is an urban myth for dissolving bodies. Historically, it actually would preserve the bodies from like having bacteria decompose them, which is why people would talk about quicklime being on bodies. So if you have murdered a drifter and you're trying to dispose of the corpse, do not use quicklime. That is something I learned from that.
Not legal advice.
Yeah, no. Also, don't murder drifters.
Yes.
But the other one is like, I had my YouTube algorithm for a while was nothing but these sort of gun testing YouTubes because I was trying, well, because there was a scene in book two where someone is standing in front of a car with a bulletproof glass window shooting at it. And I needed to look at roughly what caliber a bulletproof glass window could like conceivably stop before the bullets just go through it. Because like it's a common misconception, for example, that Kevlar does not stop rifle bullets. You need to have a ceramic plate in it. And so I didn't want to have sort of a Kevlar situation going on where, you know, the bulletproof glass will stop pistol bullets, but not rifle bullets. And so I spent forever on that. And it's just one of those things where like, I like to focus on writing. I don't like to focus on realism research. Sometimes I have to do it in my cyberpunk fantasy. But if I'm writing about some guy with, you know, a magic sword fighting a Yeti or something like that, I don't have to research that. I'm good.
it's my favorite comment on heretical fishing. It's like there's a pet crab. And the main character just like scratches the pet crab, and the pet crab is like happy about it. And then when I was like, the one thing that really took me out was that crabs don't have like, like sensory elements in their shells. Like it couldn't feel getting petted. I'm like, dude, this crab can shoot like aura beams from its claws and like evolve in like 2 days. And that's your hang up. Like this is a like magical cultivation world. And like your hang up is like that crab. Okay, but like the thing is some of the people do have these hangups, and that's fine.
The thing is like I have though, like I can't think of any right now, but I absolutely know that I have them where I just have these weird things where like if you do a very particular thing my brain just kind of like hiccups and it's like no, but you can't do that. And it's like there's magic. You're a level 11 ranger, like of course you can do that, but my brain just like has like the buffering, you know, thing going on. And I, you know, I get why it happens to readers, but it's also one of those things where like anytime I'm dealing with the real world, it's real easy to run into those things where you knock someone out of immersion. And so I just don't like messing with it.
For me, it's like the other thing is like the arrogant young master thing. And that's something that I learned while doing pen and paper roleplay. Because I liked the idea of having like this kind of like evil boss, kind of like a new kind of character from Despicable Me. And I sucked at it because I just treated like guys like badly all the time. And that's not what it's about, right? The idea is that you need to act badly and at the same time let people know you still care about them. And you can write that character that you mentioned, but it's very hard because at the very first page, you need to make the reader aware that this is A, just banter, or B, if they are like this, you need to immediately after make them vulnerable, to make them relatable, right? So I don't know, have your boss like really scream at it, scream at your main character and be like a complete asshole, and like describe him like he has always been an asshole, and then at the end of it, he like kind of like breaks down, like the main character does something like brave, like say like I don't know, like. Look, like you're really scaring me right now. Do I have to be afraid for my job? And then the boss kind of like breaks down because he never wanted to be like the mean guy. And he realizes, oh shit, he has been the mean guy. Doesn't mean he has to change immediately, but right, you kind of make characters believable, right? Make them not mono.
And that's part of what happened with that book is I realized that I really wish that I had infinite time so I could go back and rewrite it because I could write that character correctly, but writing that character correctly would mean probably another 5 or 6 chapters focusing on the relationship between them. And a lot of what pacing is in writing is a lot of characters are abbreviated where everyone kind of knows who a character is from a scene and a half because we've seen that character in 2 other books. We've seen that character in an anime. Like you know, there's sort of these tropes where like when you have your spell sword main character that has quippy one-liners, you can kind of fill in the blanks even if it isn't on the page. But if you're doing something new, if you're doing something like, you know, having a mean character be vulnerable, you kind of need to write out every step and you can't skip any steps. And that means that, you know, if I'm writing a 40 chapter novel, I would need to spend 6-8 chapters on developing this person properly. And that's 6 to 8 chapters that I can't spend on, you know, getting sick loot and stabbing monsters, which is what my readers actually want, rather than this character arc.
I mean, it's no pun intended here, like mixing kale in your smoothie, right? It's really about the right balance, and characterization is fun. And you don't always like if you're thinking about Dungeon Crawler Carl, not everything is a fight, right? Like the fights are actually pretty short.
Yep.
Right? I mean, like the extent of it is long, but the fight scenes themselves are very short. And then they talk again, and then they fight, and then they talk again, and then fight.
Yep.
Because like you can only make fighting so interesting. Okay, cool. Tell me about one book that you love and why is it awesome?
So I'm gonna give you two. These are my two favorite books ever.
Everyone does that. I tell them, tell me one book, and they give me 4 or 10 or 15.
Well, I got it down to two. No, so it's the Dune movies came out, so it felt like a cop out to just go with Dune. But I've loved Dune forever. I have always considered it the science fiction Lord of the Rings because it's just so lore dense. And like the follow-up books are good too, but the original Dune is just such a masterpiece. And if you like the movie, sit down and read the book. It is wackier than the movie. Like the there is a lot of weird psychedelic tantric sex stuff going on that I'm not sure it needed to be in there, but it sure as hell is in there. And the rest of it is so good that you're just kind of like, yeah, well, that happened. Let's not talk about the eugenic nuns that control the galaxy. Let's just keep going here, right? Then it's like you get into the sequels where you start getting into like the Honored Matrix and all that, where you're like, it gets really, really funny. And so like one thing that like a couple of my Twitter friends and I will do as a running joke is anytime someone mentions something weird in Dune, we'll just pop in and out of context start talking about the really, really messed up stuff from like Chapter House, Heretics, or you know, something like that. Where it's like, yeah, there's a sex cult around a worm, and then you just leave it at that and like just walk out. Yeah, no, it happens. It's weird, man.
So Dune, like Tolkien hated Dune. He never said why, but he hated it. And it's really interesting to know, like, to understand, like, why. Because, like, Dune is, like, very, very gray and immoral. And for Tolkien, everything was like, no, it's, like, black and white. You have good and evil, period. But that's the only one thing. The other thing, like, about Dune that most people don't know is, like, Frank Herbert was, like, super homophobic. Like, super homophobic. Right? So the reason, like, I think Duke Harkonnen has many like nubile male sex slaves and shit like that. And
he is
like
quite explicitly a pedophile in the book.
Yeah. He's a pedophile, and like he has like this, like in the movies he just floats, right? He's like floats on this autograph. In the books he's described as though he was like dancing on his tiptoes and shit. So like very flamboyant, very effeminate. And Frank Herbert actually like had a gay son, and he forbid him from seeing his dying mother, like but you gotta think about it, it's still a good book.
Well, so it's a good book, and like that reminds me of like the Baron Harkonnen. The Lynch movie isn't really Dune, but you should also watch it anyway. It's barely Dune. David Lynch I think famously didn't actually finish reading Dune. but what I love about that is like I don't know if you've ever read about the Disney Evil Queen thing, where they there were unsurprisingly a whole bunch of gay creators that were involved with Disney in like the golden age in like the 70s and the 80s and all that, and one of the things they did is a lot of Disney villains were like gay coded. And there, retrospectively, there's a whole bunch of, you know, back and forth on whether this is good or whether it was bad. I know a lot of people who kind of empathize with these people and like, we're like, for example, like Scar, there was some heavy coding going on there, right? Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of people who are like, he's a really cool character because of the way he's coded, and they, you know, love him for it. Which brings me back to the Lynch Dune, where Baron Harkonnen, rather than an evil mastermind, is basically a Disney evil queen. Yeah. Like, he's just like flouncing around and like speaking in couplets for no discernible reason. And
like, the like, speaking of Disney, right? So Disney, I think, has a share in Fox, or Fox owns Disney, something like this.
Everyone owns everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of dystopia. But the other thing is, I think Fox owns the movie rights for the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So Dr. Frankenfurter is like a Disney queen, Disney princess, which is really interesting. Like, I believe balances all out.
Yeah.
So, no, it's super interesting. Literally, like, because like the entire like caveat on this podcast, again, obviously, is like, if you're going out and saying like, oh, look, like, why does everyone want to like shove gay stuff into my face? Like, I get it. Doesn't feel good, right? You don't want to see it. It's fine. The other thing though is like, it's not made for you specifically, right? It's made for other people who just like have their own needs, and they haven't had like a movie that has like a gay main protagonist or whatever in a long time, and they want to have one too. And you're not getting like less because of it. If you really don't like it all that much, like, okay, cool. Yeah, you have to skip out on like whatever, some sort of like franchise or movie or something like that. But then the next one is probably going to be like hetero again, or you know, another one that you can also.
Well, I mean, what I try and do in my writing is I try and mimic what I see, which is that gay people exist and they're not. Yeah, or so I've heard. Gay people exist and they're not like, you know, stereotypes. They're not. They're not one of these things from like a 90s sitcom where they like walk into the room and put their hands on their hips and say, I like penis. Like, that isn't what usually happens. Maybe a brunch, but like, that isn't what maybe usually happens. Mm. Yeah. Maybe a brunch. So like what I try and do is you know, there will be gay people in my books and they're usually just sort of people. Like, it's going to happen. It's not going to be front and center. I do not feel comfortable as a straight man doing a coming out book. So I will never do that. The books where I have same-sex romance, I sort of treat it as like it was never like the sexuality of the people involved was never a question. So there's never any sort of like exploration on why that's happening. Because again, I don't feel like I can fully understand why that's happening. So I feel like if I tried to write it, it would be crap, and I don't want to do that. But like, there are plenty of gay people out there, and I don't want to make someone's sexuality the focus of my books. And it won't be because I'm writing books about magic and swords. And sometimes the person holding the sword is white. Sometimes they're black. Sometimes they're straight. Sometimes they're gay. But ultimately, the focus is on them stabbing a goblin, not, you know, the hand that's holding the sword.
Exactly. The I think it's a very good take. Like, the other take I think that more people should follow in writing is that just because there's a gay character in your story, the protagonists or don't have to react in a certain way, either good or bad, right? So for example, if you're writing like, if you're like super pro LGBTQ or whatever, then you need to, and you have like a gay character in there, it's so easy to go like, oh, everyone loves the gay character for what they are, right? Because that's a fulfillment, wish fulfillment, it's hard and more realistic, and it will also cause way less of a backlash if you have good people don't like gay people for the wrong reasons or for the right reasons or whatever, right? It's really, really interesting. Like, that's a dynamic that you can approach more, because like in real life that also happens, right? Like, sometimes your parents don't like love you to pieces until like you come out as gay, right? Does it make them horrible people? Maybe not. I'm not one to judge. right? But like also like people who've been assholes their entire time, like the entire time, like don't like someone at all. They will like happily go out and like use your new pronouns without mocking you for it, right? Like people are multifaceted. People are like, especially in relationship with other people. And if you just go like, oh, they're good or bad, and everyone has to think they're good or bad because they're gay, that is very reductive. And I wouldn't recommend doing it because one way or another, you're going to get people who don't like it.
Well, no, like Blessed Time has a bi character in it.
Yeah.
And he's a flawed character, but it's because he has an alcohol problem and he's like a braggart. And like there are problems that are caused because of alcohol consumption. And like the only like interaction his sexuality has with that is when he actually has a boyfriend. His boyfriend is there kind of saying like, seriously, put the fucking drink down, man. Like, you know, that sort of thing. But beyond that, like, I mean... Again, I feel like it is a statement to not include any gay people whatsoever in a book. Just as much as putting a character and making the sole focus of what is ostensibly like a magic academy or something like that be on someone's sexuality is also a statement. It's not necessarily a bad statement. It's just you're writing a different kind of book than what I'm writing. But like, if, again, they're there. Just make them normal people. They're normal people. Make them normal people.
If you want to, exactly, right. Like it's that's the funny thing. People are like, people often go like, oh, this is discrimination. No, it's just bad writing. Right. If like, there's this one scene, and I think it's like, The Division, the video game. At the very start, like one of the characters, like, oh yeah, my wife. And it feels very out of place because why is it being underlined so hard? Right.
Well, and that's the thing is like, I do get why people get pissed off because there are things like, you know, what was it like for Star Wars? They're advertising how there's going to be the first lesbian kiss or whatever. And it's literally like they're rapidly panning over like a victory scene. And like if you slow it down, you can get like two people kissing and you're like, why are you making this a marketing focus? Like like if, you know, I get that if there's a bunch of people making out because we just won a battle, you're probably going to have some same sex stuff going on. But like, why are you making it front and center? If it's something people are doing, you know, it's something people are doing, turning it into a marketing thing. I think that's A, I get why people feel like that's being pushed in their faces, and B, I feel like that's not necessarily a good thing for, you know, LGBTQ people, because it's like, I think they just want to see themselves in books and they want to be able to identify with the books and the movies without having some sort of marketing exec be like, you're a profitable demographic.
This is like, I could talk for ages about the fact that like, the people making the decisions are not close enough to the communities that they interact with. But like I said, in ivory towers, almost,
most of the problems are almost entirely that it's just marketing people that are making the decisions. Yeah. Like
there are gay marketing people.
Yeah. No, I know.
They exist. Like the thing is like everything gets like, it's like so overblown or like kind of like rainbow washed because like, maybe the person who was like, hey, let's have like, I don't know, a telecom CSD float. That's like, right? Or Christopher Suje float in Germany. Maybe that was a good idea. And then the, you know, like the full force of the entire like marketing department like went behind it and like completely blew it out of proportion. And it's no longer about the thing, which is like, hey, let's have a cool, fun thing for us. It's about like the company and representation. And this is mostly because of many, many rules and regulations and many people who have nothing to do with the subject needing to add their catch up to it. I know. Like this is like, it's really interesting that like most of the issues that we have like in like socially really boil down to corporate structures. But it's that's a different topic maybe.
Ramming a square peg into a round hole while people are just trying to live.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay, cool. Shoutouts. Oh, wait, sorry, the second book.
This one's also going to be fairly gay, actually. Cytene. It's a really interesting one. It's an old Hugo winner by CJ. I'm going to mispronounce her last name, Shirah. She is a phenomenal writer. She won a Hugo for that, Down Below Station. It is one of the, like, I'm trying to think of other books around that time that did have a gay main character, and I really, because it was like an 80s novel, I really can't think of anything big from that time that, like, you know, like, there are only a couple of them. But it's also one of those things where, like, it's not, it's kind of what I'm talking about, where it really isn't the story. He just happens to be gay. Yeah. But what it is it's a hard science fiction, like, psychological thriller, but not what you would think. Like, the psychology is a huge part of it. It's a research institute where this incredibly important and powerful person was killed, and they're trying to figure out what happened. And it turns out, while they're doing this investigation into what happened, that this person was a psychologist, and she was running a project that was this weird form of immortality where they were trying to use clones to recreate yourself. But the way that the way that this worked is the clone would recreate a body that was the same as yours, but it wouldn't be the same mind. And so what they were doing is they were going through your entire life and trying to find all of the things that made you you and recreating them. Like, I'm not going to get too much into the spoilers with, like, the main character, but there's, like, two or three characters in this. But a lot of what it is them taking these, functionally, these geniuses and saying, like, what makes you a genius is functionally the trauma you went through that, you know, forced you to work as hard, you know, as hard as you did to maximize your talent. And it's, so it's them using this closed environment in this, like, closed research institute where they're in control of everything that's happening, to try and force people through the same traumas that the like person that cloned them went through. And it's about these people, like, only like halfway through the novel fully realizing that they are being, like, intentionally, like, traumatized and remolded to be these, like, historical genius type people. And all set in the same sort of, like, realm as this murder mystery. And it is honestly one of the best books I've ever read. It is incredibly dense. It's almost entirely literally inside people's heads. So, if you're going there expecting sword fights, there's, like, a couple, like, sort of spy thriller things, but it's really, really, really just people trying to unlock what's happening to them, what happened with this murder, and all of that. So it's like a, I don't know. It's a really well-written book. If you want to get better about your craft at writing, I'd recommend reading it too. It is more science fiction. What was it?
What's it called?
Cytene. C-Y-T-E-E-N.
Okay. Nice.
And I always recommend that one. It messed me up for weeks. That's the best thing I can say about a book.
Okay. Shoutouts.
If I were shouting people out, I mean, honestly, I pretty much like everyone in the field. The people that I sort of learned to write with, I will always shout out. So J.M. Clark, Mark of the Fool, Valron Prime, Ashborn Primordial. Oh God, what was that first series he wrote? I just remember that the main character's initials were OPMC, and that was half the joke. Magnus, Crazy Cody, Void, Voidborn Devourer, Key Equals MC Squared, Crownfall. All people that I, you know, learned a lot from, wrote a lot with, all just good people. But again, I mean, there aren't a whole lot of bad people in the genre. And this is, like, one of the cool things about the genre is that all the writers in it are incredibly close with each other and incredibly close with the readers compared to literally any other genre I can think of.
Cool. Yeah. All right. With that, I think we've like wrong broken the 1 hour mark. So thanks everyone for coming to the Crit RPG podcast. This has been great. And we're going to keep talking. We're going to keep talking for a while longer. And that stuff is going to be in the extended material over on Patreon that you can subscribe to if you want to. If you don't want to, I would still appreciate it if you would leave a like, maybe a comment, a follow, you know the drill. Because, yeah, it helps me out. It helps me make more of these podcasts and alleviate the tedium that is my day job. So, yeah. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll go to the moon. Kale, any last words?
Well, it's nice talking with everyone. Read my books, read other people's books, read a lot of books.
Good. Thank you. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening and or watching. And I'll see you next time. And if you're on Patreon, the show goes on.